Congressman Banks' vaccination status. Governor Holcomb insists the state fair is safe, plus the Ready Grant deadline extended, and more on Indiana Week in Review for the week ending August 6th, 2021.
Indiana Week in Review is made possible by the supporters of Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations and by Ice Miller, a full-service law firm committed to helping clients build, grow, and protect their interests. More at icemiller.com.
Indiana Congressman Jim Banks recently told Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette reporter Nikki Kelly, hey, we know her, that he received the COVID-19 vaccine, but he won't tell others to get it. Banks told Kelly that he wasn't hiding his vaccination status, but that no one had asked before she did. And he says that because he's not a doctor or a pastor, he doesn't believe he's in any position to tell people what to do regarding the vaccine. Other Republican leaders at the state level have been outspoken about urging people to get vaccinated, notably Governor Eric Holcomb, who makes a case for the vaccine at many of the public events he attends. Does Congressman Banks have a duty to encourage people to get the COVID vaccine? It's the first question for our Indiana Week in Review panel. Democrat Greg Stowers, Republican Mike O'Brien, John Schwanes, host of Indiana Lawmakers, and Nikki Kelly, Statehouse reporter for the Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette. I'm Indiana Public Broadcasting Statehouse reporter Brandon Smith. Mike O'Brien, we've seen a lot of public officials get the vaccine very publicly and then tell others to get it. We've seen some refuse to say whether they've gotten it. Is Banks trying to have it both ways?
I don't think so, but I think all these guys are in a different position. It's unfair to compare him to the governor, who has an entire agency, whose job it is to coordinate and distribute the vaccine, right? And record the data and understand, you know, distribute tests and understand all that data. So they're in very different roles in this. And I think it just depends on their circumstance. Lindsey Graham, we saw this week, was very outspoken. He said he had spoken to former President Trump, encouraged him to encourage people to get vaccinated. I'm not accusing you of gotcha journalism, of course, but like the point is like to kind of get him a little bit, because his base is the demographic of people that tend to be more apprehensive about getting the vaccine. And this kind of setup kind of makes that worse. It causes those people to just kind of dig in, if not defend them. It's bizarre to me, though, still, that the politics are kind of like generally, I mean, if we're talking in big general terms, generally based Republicans who are suspicious of it or are unwilling to get it for whatever reason. A lot of it is politics. But President, no one deserves more credit, I think, in the development of the vaccine, certainly, than President Trump and the federal government.
I think the White House Dr. Fauci said that this week.
Right, and under his leadership and the red tape they broke through and moving this vaccine to market as fast as they could, and now it's the same people who would die for him.
Who might literally die.
That might actually die for him and don't have to. So,
Does Congressman Banks have a responsibility to say, yes, I got it, you should get it too?
Yeah, I think he certainly does. I think there are a number of outspoken Democrats who would say yes, and a lot of quieter Republicans who would also say yes to that. You know, but I think at a higher level, it's a question of leadership. His constituents elected him to lead, and leaders have to do tough things. But when your aspirations are outweighing your realities, I think that becomes an issue. And I think that's what we're finding with Representative Banks.
Do you think he's walking a kind of fine line politically here? Do you think for him this is the right line to walk?
I have no idea. I mean, that's up to his constituents, right? So it's not up to me. I honestly had not planned to ask him that question. It just sort of popped into my head at the last minute. I was interviewing him for another story, completely different. My Twitter notifications are a freaking mess right now. But I will say one thing he said was, you know, he said repeatedly, like, I'm not a doctor. It's not my job to tell them. But I also see him saying all the time, follow the science on masks, follow the science on kids. But he's not at the same time saying, follow the science on vaccinations.
I can't believe I'm asking this question, but is he hurt politically by saying, yes, I got vaccinated?
I can't believe I'm answering this question. Yes, I think to a certain extent with some of his constituents. Again, this is kind of the bizarre world in which we find ourselves. I would have answered your first question, does he have an obligation? I think certainly as an elected official whose own federal agencies are the ones who are strongly recommending these. Presumably, he believes in the CDC and the National Institutes for Health, and presumably he would want then to weigh in with what his own agencies say. Also, I haven't seen the same reluctance, even since he's not a physician, to weigh in on any number of other issues, including reproductive health issues with women and so forth. So there's sort of a selectivity, perhaps.
Let's make it more controversial.
Well, as long as they have her Twitter. But let me just say one thing. Frank Luntz, who's a lot smarter about these things than I, who is one of the geniuses of political opinion, reading the tea leaves and advising any number of Republicans for probably 20, 30 years, and he has been doing work on this issue about why aren't people getting the vaccine and what needs to happen for them to get the vaccine. And he says that if your congressman or even your U.S. senator weighs in, or the president, doesn't matter. It really, his research shows, has to be somebody that you already have an existing relationship with from the medical community. His argument being your personal physician, that your family's physician, or your child's pediatrician, or your pharmacist. So he has been begging physicians and pharmacists to produce short videos that they can distribute to their customer base or their patient base, begging people to do this. And he's about to come out with a report, I think, in the next week or so, so here's your little heads up on that.
I've seen some of those numbers, too. The trick here is, how many people still have a personal physician?
It may not matter, but banks, even if you weighed in, it might not matter.
All right. Well, Governor Eric Holcomb says he'll be monitoring Indiana's COVID-19 data as the state fair is underway, but he's convinced it will be safe. The state fair typically draws nearly 1 million people over its 2.5 weeks, and Indiana is in the middle of the sharpest spike in daily COVID cases since the pandemic's earliest days. The fair doesn't have any mandated COVID restrictions for its guests, but Holcomb says if people want to feel more comfortable, they're free to wear a mask.
That is one way to add another extra layer of not just peace of mind, but safety.
The CDC recently issued guidance that even vaccinated people should wear masks indoors in areas of significant spread, which includes almost all of Indiana. Much of the state fair, though not all of it, is outdoors. Greg Stowers, should we be concerned about the state fair and a COVID spike?
I can't believe that I have to say yes to this, but I would have to say yes. And when we look at our vaccination rate, I think we're under 50% right now around the state. I mean, I don't think this is a political issue. I think this is an issue of realities. And unfortunately, our governor is in a really tough spot right now, which puts us all in a tough spot. But it all comes down to leadership. We need leaders to lead and to press us to do what's best and to do what's right.
Obviously, we were all looking forward to the state fair being back after it was canceled for the first time since World War II last year, obviously in the middle of the earlier days of the pandemic. And this spike has happened really close to the beginning of it. But are you surprised that there aren't any sort of restrictions in place beyond, maybe wear a mask, I guess?
I don't think I am, because if you look around, I went to a White Sox game last night, right, in Chicago. We're coming out of county fair season where there were no restrictions on county fairs, and, thousands of people are gathering it in smaller areas in county fairs county fairgrounds. If this were some kind of outlier based on, what other people can do, go to a concert or go to a baseball game or go to Victory Field tonight or whatever, then, yeah, it'd be, unusual. But unless we're going to, really start looking at shutting down indoor activities, I don't know why we'd start looking at shutting down outdoor activities or things that are largely outdoor. I mean, most of the fair is. I don't know, maybe a cut down on people walking around with turkey legs or something. I don't know.
Might as well cancel the fair at that point.
You can't eat the turkey leg with the mask on.
No, you can't. I mean, is the fact that a lot of the fair is outdoors maybe help this situation?
I think it does help the situation, but I think it goes beyond the surroundings. A question like this is tough because it invites a lot of generalizations and sweeping statements. So please forgive me for making sweeping statements. But the fair tends to attract a largely rural crowd. I mean, that's what it's about.
For Indiana agriculture.
I mean, there are people who go to the Midway and so forth. But... And that's an audience that was not wearing masks to a large degree, even at the height of the orange, reddest of red maps when there were requirements in place, when local health departments were mandating it, and they said, phooey, that's not for me. I don't believe it, and it's not going to happen. So indoor,
so
outdoor.
So essentially wouldn't have mattered.
It wouldn't have mattered, I don't think. It's just the situation here, and nobody's going to reverse course. Now there's just too much.
No one's worried about going.
There's
if you're
too
not
much
vaccinated,
pride.
You're not worried about going because you're not. You didn't make it an effort. You didn't make an effort to get vaccinated in the last like 8 months.
I guess my.
If you're vaccinated,
then you
also
should be
don't
okay.
care.
Of course, last
you
week
sure
I suggested the attractiveness of deep fried vaccines, but I guess no one took me up on my. No one took me up on my suggestion.
Yeah, this goes to a larger question about Governor Holcomb's decisions lately, which is through how many months of the pandemic, he followed CDC guidance, whether it was in the orders he issued for the state or even in his own personal behavior. And for the first time, he's really not doing that anymore.
Yeah, he's not. He did not reimpose masks for state buildings when they previously were required. He's not personally wearing a mask indoors when at events. He's been at a number of them this week without doing it. So I would love to hear from him why this time he
it's because of the vaccine. It's because you have the opportunity to not get this or not get very
ill or die. Yeah, but the CDC is still saying
it.
If you're vaccinated.
But it's different than it was a year ago. I mean, if he's going to say, I'm following the science, following the science. Okay, great. Well, people need to follow the science. People need, if you're not vaccinated, follow the CDC protocols. As individuals, it's no longer where we're going to shut down from top down. That's what I've been saying for like weeks. I know I've been making kind of light of it, but it's serious. Like we're not going to go back and dismantle the economy when you just don't feel like getting a vaccine for whatever reason.
All right. Well, time now for viewer feedback. Each week we pose an unscientific online poll question in conjunction with our Ice Miller email and text alerts. This week's question, will the Indiana State Fair cause a spike in COVID-19 cases? A yes or B no. Last week we asked you if Governor Holcomb should reimpose a statewide mask mandate in K-12 schools. 75% of you say yes, just 25% say no. If you'd like to take part in the poll, go to wfyi.org/IWIR and look for the poll. Well, Indiana officials are giving regions around the state an additional month to submit proposals for up to $50 million for economic development. Governor Eric Holcomb extended the deadline this week to the end of September for the Regional Economic Acceleration and Development Initiative, helpfully called READY. The $500 million program launched in May. It aims to expedite small and large-scale projects in communities that would improve quality of life and retain and attract workers to the area. 91 of the 92 counties in the state are participating. Fayette County is the only one not included in any of the 18 regional groups identified. Proposals will be reviewed October through November, with the first round selections announced in December.
John Schwanisch, anytime you hear about a deadline getting pushed back, I think your first thought is, did they not get enough applications? That would be pretty surprising for this program, wouldn't it, though?
One would think it's pretty surprising, given that a lot of businesses and counties that encourage those businesses are coming out, emerging from, we hope, the epidemic and trying to rebound in a strong fashion. So you would think that the focus is here. There's a widespread awareness that this money was out there and that these grants were available. Maybe the governor is suggesting he wants all 92 counties to wait for Fayette County come in. figure something out so he can say, because that sounds a lot better than, you know, 91 out of 92. I'm being somewhat facetious there, but you would think that there should be huge demand for this. And if it's not, shame on economic development officials across the state, I guess.
This harkens back to the Regional Cities Initiative. It's kind of based on that, though it's not exactly the same. And Regional Cities was very popular. So do we expect that this will be just as popular?
I mean, I would think so. I mean, maybe they saw a couple applications and maybe they weren't fleshed out quite enough. And I'm not sure also with READY what the matching requirements are, so I don't know if there's a problem maybe getting the sort of public sector and private sector buy-in together. So hopefully this next month will result in some better applications.
Yeah, let's hope this doesn't turn into an Indigo situation again. There is
A general sentiment among the General Assembly when Governor Holcomb proposed this, and then obviously they put a lot of money towards it when we had all of this money to spend, that we liked regional cities. This is a more advanced take on it. This is a good thing. But I heard some, particularly Democrats, say, but we have to be careful about who's deciding how this money is spent, that it's not just big businesses, that it's you're getting more community, small businesses, yeah. community-based organizations. How do we make sure that that's what's going to happen?
Well, you know, I think, first off, to your initial question, I kind of thought about this as a college student where, you know, you walk into class and the professor would say, hey, you know, we're going to give you an additional deadline on that, and you'd have like three or four people in the classroom say,
Oh, thank God.
And then you'd have everybody else. But I think, you know, based on my research for Ready Grants, it was instituted to really stand in the gap. And I think it's really important that we take the time to be measured about how we approach that. And as we look at a lot of the opportunity that has been provided by President Joe Biden as a result of that, I think it's important that we take the time to really measure how we stand in the gap, how we provide for equitable solutions for different communities, and also take a look at really the economic impact of the ways that the money is going to be distributed.
Regional cities, it ended up being a one-time thing. It was this idea. They found some money, which at the time was a tax amnesty program, and then it was just gone. Is this going to be another one where, while we have this money right now, we'll spend it on this and then it'll go away and we'll do something new 5 years from now? Or is there a way to make this? Well, is there a way to make something like this more sustainable?
I think we've had a history in Indiana on both sides. Both Democrats and Republicans have had a history of these types of programs. Build Indiana Fund 25 years ago. You know, we've had versions of this. Particularly, they tend to come up when times are good and revenue is strong, which is how it should be. I don't think you read anything into the deadline other than there's a lot of interest in this. And there's 91 counties, but those counties are partnering with other counties, partnering with municipalities, partnering with nonprofits and corporations. And that takes a lot of coordination, a lot of time, but why not give them more time to make sure they have the best application put forward?
One of the things that a lot of folks talked about with regional cities was trying to get Indiana communities to stop thinking quite so small in terms of how they partner together. It was very city versus city, county versus county. And the whole point was, no, we want you to work much more collectively. And they're doing that again now, perhaps on even, you know, bigger scale, certainly with more money. So is that maybe the biggest lasting impact of a program like this, is forcing these communities to go, well, hey, I don't have to compete with my neighbor quite so much?
It would be a great byproduct of this process if people start to think that way. But that probably is a bit Pollyannish, because for two reasons. One, I like that word, huh? If you think about, you mentioned the Build Indiana Fund and other funds that have been dedicated to this, in even a more formal fashion, they are always depleted, it seems, when the times turn south. So that might be an issue there. And then you also look at this notion of territoriality and so forth. You see it in the General Assembly. So, I mean, if lawmakers are saying, we want you to think about the state or about a region, what do you tell the lawmakers who don't want to do something for Indianapolis because that's somehow the enemy, even though that's the state's capital and probably would raise, be the tide that lifts all boats, or northern Indiana versus southern Indiana? I mean, we see these sort of fiefdoms and this infighting, regardless of party, in the General Assembly. So for them to proclaim it as, you know, we've moved past that, it's time for everybody to join hands in a collective manner. It's not really realistic.
And perhaps we may have, you know, underestimated how difficult that is to get all these regions to work together. I mean, you look at
a great concept.
Right. I mean, you look at Hamilton County, you look at Marion County. They all have different challenges. So I think that's something also to keep in mind.
One other thing I want to add about this, which is to differentiate it from regional cities, and I asked him a sustainability question, but with regional cities it was, well, the first round, and then we're going to use this money for that, and then there was no second round. This one, though, they built in a lot of money for it, so that first round really will have a second round.
Well, to be fair, though, under regional cities, it was like a huge amount of money to just like two projects.
Yeah,
this
two
are much
projects,
smaller
right.
individual you know, targeted projects. Mm-hmm. So they did
so more money
rounds.
For even more projects.
Yeah. But smaller projects.
Right, smaller projects. Well, Indiana had to pay more than $800,000 in a failed attempt to block the public from getting information about the drugs it uses for lethal injection.
The payout came at the end of a six-year-long lawsuit filed by Washington, D.C. attorney Catherine Toomey. She had filed a records request in 2014 seeking details about the drugs Indiana uses in lethal injections. Beyond the $800,000 in legal fees, the state also disclosed that all of its lethal injection drugs are expired and it hasn't purchased any more. Nikki Kelly, lawmakers stepped into this issue in the middle of the case, did they not?
Yeah, they actually won a court ruling in 16, the person suing, and then in 17, at like 2 a.m. in the morning, the legislature put in a little retroactive state law.
Did they put that into the budget, in fact?
Yeah, I believe so. So somewhere along the way, the judge said, hey, no, you're trying to get around my order. The Supreme Court agreed, and they finally finished it up. I think we need to actually look at the next step, which is, do we still have the death penalty here? We haven't put anyone on since 13. We haven't executed anyone since 2009. We have eight people there. Several of them have exhausted their appeals for years, and they're just sitting there.
Yeah, I mean, this is now very public information, which is that the state can't use the drugs it has, and it hasn't ordered any more. So there is effectively not a death penalty at the moment in Indiana. If you're a prosecutor, you like having as many tools in your bag as you can, right?
That's a hell of a tool.
But it is a hell of a tool. But, I mean, do you really still have that tool anymore?
I suppose you can still use that as a bludgeon to try to, I mean, who knows if the state will decide to go to a guillotine or hanging or something if the drugs aren't available. And there's some probably who would line up to author that bill. I mean, the sad thing here is that there's any notion that this information isn't public. Of all of the things that the state of Indiana does as a government, paving roads, running schools, I mean, you name it. The one thing that shows that they have a unique power and authority under our legal system is to end someone's life. And the notion that that is somehow has to be secret among all these other things is insane. And my apologies to, well, I am a First Amendment absolutist and a public records absolutist, so I guess I won't apologize to anybody on the other side. There are a few friends of mine who have apparently fallen into confusion on this issue. But my clarity is intact. If anything should be public, it's this.
Before I get to you, Mike O'Brien, Nikki, why was this controversial in the first? Why was this something we were trying to shield from the public?
I think there was a movement across the nation that when they found out the manufacturer of the drugs, then there would be like a boycott against that manufacturer. So the manufacturers didn't want to be identified as being part of an execution.
What a shame.
Right.
All right, so now I'm going to ask you the fundamental question, which Nikki already brought up. Should we still have the death penalty in Indiana?
I'm a conservative, and I don't think we should, because I don't trust the government to get this right. It's
That's probably
the most critical thing, right?
There,
I mean, it's the most critical thing. It's a person's life, and if any government has ever gotten it wrong, and we know this one and others have, then they should not have that power.
Same question.
I'm going to deflect on necessarily the government getting it wrong piece. I think there's just a moral
Smart.
Piece for
I
me.
Right.
But I do think it's wrong, and I do think we need to rid ourselves in Indiana of it. But, like I said, I will sort of deflect on the government piece.
And lastly, Nikki, is there any chance the General Assembly takes away the death penalty?
I don't know, but like I said, I'm not sure. At some point, one of these people sitting there under execution date, for 5 years, maybe they can argue, look, can we just convert this to life without parole? Because,
What's
is that...
Point? Right.
But that's easy for lawmakers who never want to go on record voting against the death penalty. They can have their cake and eat it, too. Nobody's being executed, but they can still say, I am four square behind execution, capital punishment.
All right, well, finally, the Olympics are coming to an end. A very different experience in Tokyo this year amid COVID-19 limitations. But there are also some new sports, including skateboarding and surfing. Mike O'Brien, if you could add a sport to the Olympic Games, what would it be?
Nikki and I had the same one, so I'm not going to steal it from her.
Okay.
Especially since I accused her of gotcha journalism earlier. I heard a great idea that the Olympics should not be professional athletes. You should just get a letter that you have been selected to as a
like
citizen of the United States.
Yeah, that would be an interesting.
That's just your public service. You've got to go be in the Olympics.
All right, what have you got?
So I heard this. I'm like, maybe online shopping?
Ooh, that is competitive.
But, after last weekend with some buddies, any of y'all ever played spades before?
Yeah.
So spades is like a little bit better than euchre, and just some of the
better than euchre.
Oh, I don't know.
Come on.
You almost got out of the show clean.
All right,
I've
quickly.
Watched cornhole tournaments, and that needs to be in the Olympics.
Cornhole in the Olympics. I like that. All right, that's Indiana Week in Review for this week. Our panel is Democrat Greg Stowers, Republican Mike O'Brien, John Schwannis of Indiana Lawmakers, and Nikki Kelly of the Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette. If you'd like a podcast of this program, you can find it at WFYI.org/IWIR, or starting Monday, you can stream it or get it on demand from Xfinity and on the WFYI app. I'm Brandon Smith of Indiana Public Broadcasting. Join us next time, because a lot can happen in an Indiana week.
Indiana Week in Review is made possible by the supporters of Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations and by Ice Miller. Ice Miller is a full-service law firm committed to helping clients build, grow, and protect their interests. More at icemiller.com. The opinions expressed are solely those of the panelists. Indiana Week in Review is a WFYI production in association with Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations.